History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. There's a great biography of Christopher Columbus by Samuel Eliot Morison called Admiral of the Ocean Sea, A Life of Christopher Columbus. I want to start off this episode by reading a passage about what Columbus's voyages did to Europe, how it fundamentally changed it, because the ways that the discovery of the New World permanently altered the intellectual landscape of the West portends a lot for what space exploration will do for us in the near-term future. Here's the passage. At the end of 1492, most men in Western Europe felt exceedingly gloomy about the future. Christian civilization appeared to be shrinking in area and dividing into hostile units as its sphere contracted. For over a century, there had been no important advance in natural science and registration, and universities dwindled as the instruction they offered became increasingly jejune and lifeless. Institutions were decaying, well-meaning people were growing cynical or desperate, and many intelligent men, for want of something better to do, were endeavoring to escape the present through studying the pagan past. Yet even as the chroniclers of Nuremberg were correcting their proofs from Coburger's press, a Spanish caravel named Niña scudded before a winter gale into Lisbon with news of a discovery that was to give old Europe another chance. In a few years, we find the mental picture completely changed. Strong monarchs are stamping out privy conspiracy and rebellion. The church, purged and chastened by the Protestant Reformation, puts her house in order. New ideas flare up throughout Italy, France, Germany, and the northern nations. Faith in God revives and the human spirit is renewed. The change is complete and startling. A new envisagement of the world has begun, and men are no longer sighing after the imaginary golden age that lay in the distant past, but speculating as to the golden age that might possibly lie in the oncoming future. Christopher Columbus belongs to an age that was past, yet he became the sign and symbol of this new age of hope, glory, and accomplishment. His medieval faith impelled him to a modern solution, expansion. With private space companies launching rockets, satellites, and people at a record pace, and with the US and other governments committing to a future in space, today's guest, Glenn Reynolds, looks at how we got here, where we're going, and why it matters for all of humanity. Reynolds is a law professor and a former executive vice president of the National Space Society, and he thinks commercial space is essential to the future. He's the author of the book America's New Destiny in Space, and in this episode, he discusses America's future in space, which will be dominated by the private sector rather than the work of government space agencies. We explore how space will inspire innovation, possibly create trillions of dollars in wealth, and pump incredible new energy into human civilization. Reynolds describes three phases of spaceflight in human history so far. There was the visionary phase in the early 20th century, the command economy phase from the Apollo to the shuttle eras, and finally a sustainable phase in which he defines as spaceflight that generates enough economic value to pay its own way. This means getting into space will become far cheaper than it used to be, and it promises to get much cheaper still. This creates immediate possibilities like cheap satellite internet from SpaceX's Starlink, but also more exotic technologies like space-based solar power, asteroid mining, and helium-3 extraction from the moon to make fusion possible. Reynolds also talks about what we need to do to bring about this future, like little government regulation and the government acting as a customer, but otherwise getting out of the way. A lot to unpack here, so I hope you enjoy this discussion with Glenn Reynolds. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me here. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this discussion. I've read your blog for a very long time and wholeheartedly endorse it. So you're quite the Renaissance man, law professor, Mark Ripto barbell enthusiast, and also a space enthusiast, but someone who's worked professionally as an advocate, president of National Space Society. Do I have that correct?
Former? Was executive chairman.
Okay. Well, definitely high up there. So before getting into what you've written, both in the form of your book and as a legal scholar, where did this come from, your interest in space?
Gosh, from my extreme youth, I guess. I mean, I grew up when there was still an Apollo program, and I grew up watching those launches as a kid and reading children's books about rockets and space. And it always seemed like the future we were promised back then, at least, would be one in which we'd be out in the solar system and exploring other planets and things like that.
Yeah, it's kind of depressing if you read Robert Heinlein from the 50s, where they're, I think, using a rail system to go up Pikes Peak in Colorado Springs, and doesn't happen nearly as quickly. Also, just in getting into the series, as I was researching the background and talking to experts like yourself, I was surprised by how much scholarship there is in the legal field of all fields that actually focuses on the near-term future implications of space. I mean, there's tons of stuff on the legal rights of asteroid mining, how land patents on Mars could be enforced in the same way that British Crown patents made land sellable in Kentucky in the 1500s. So is it because there's a lot of potential money at stake in the future that there's so much scholarship on this in the legal field?
I think that's some of it. I think also lawyers are just interested in this stuff. You know, it's from my perspective as a law professor, it's fun to be the first or one of the first to write about something. And that's just a lot easier to do in areas involving space or technology than it is to do in, say, constitutional law. In fact, space law as a field predates human activity in space. The first space law article was published by John Cobb Cooper in 1951, several years before Sputnik, looking at the question of basically whether national sovereignty extended into outer space and so on. There was a question for a while what the upward boundary of territorial sovereignty was. You know, under Roman law, your property rights in a piece of land extended in a wedge going out infinitely into the heavens. Usque ad caelum was the Roman motto, meaning ultimately to the heavens. And there was some question as to whether we'd need permission from any country to orbit above them. Cooper said probably not, and that's certainly the conclusion we came to after Sputnik. In fact, there's some talk that the United States deliberately let the Sputnik launch go ahead first because we thought that would stop the Russians from complaining when we flew over their country.
Interesting. So it seems a lot of it, I suppose, could we say property rights? That was one of the main impetus for interest in this area.
Property rights and national sovereignty. The U.S. government, starting actually even before that, before the end of World War II almost, was very interested in reconnaissance satellites. At that time, we're flying reconnaissance bombers over the Soviet Union, taking pictures, and Stalin was annoyed but couldn't do anything about it. But we knew that was technologically limited and that we would eventually not be able to do that. And Rand Corporation, in its infancy, as early as 1946, was writing about spy satellites. So that shaped a lot of U.S. government policy in the post-war era, trying to make sure there was an open path for spy satellites to fly over other countries, chiefly the Soviet Union.
Well, I wanted to hear your take on that 1967 Outer Space Treaty, but before getting too far into the weeds, could you describe the main points of your book, America's New Destiny in Space, of the three stages of spaceflight and where we are currently?
Sure. I divide history into basically three stages, as you say. The visionary phase, which goes back at least as far as like Jules Verne and Edward Everett Hale's The Brick Moon and those sort of mid-19th century semi-scientific treatments of space travel. We had, you know, essentially fairy tales about traveling to the moon going back to the Roman and Greek era. And then you have the sort of more active visionaries, people like Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, Robert Goddard, the early days of Wernher von Braun, in which they were thinking and planning, but there wasn't a lot of doing, except sort of in a proof of concept way. So that's the visionary phase. And it's amazing how much was worked out in the visionary phase. You know, Walter Hohmann, who was an insurance executive, worked out basically the principles of transfer orbits between planets. The Hohmann transfer orbit is named for him. And that was in like 1925. You transition over into what I call the command economy phase in the early 30s, when Wernher von Braun's rocket club had basically hit its limits. As Willy Ley said, it had gone as far as any club made up of people who weren't millionaires could go. And right about that time, the German Army's Ordnance Office got interested. They wanted rockets with longer range than the Paris guns of World War I had. And they started pumping money into engineering. And von Braun's rocket club turned into a government program. And that's when the command economy phase began. And that takes us through Sputnik and Apollo and the space shuttle. And I would say comes to an end about the time the space shuttle quits flying around 2011, 2012, which is not so coincidentally right about the time that we see the breakout in what they call new space, entrematerial space, like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and various other companies. And I call this phase, the phase we're in now, sustainable space, because the command economy space era was really useful. It demonstrated that you could do a lot of the stuff that the visionaries had envisioned, and they got a lot of abuse in the early days. for envisioning this. The New York Times ran an editorial talking about what a idiot that Robert Goddard was for thinking you could send a rocket to the moon, which was obviously impossible. And the command economy phase proved that was possible. You could go to the moon, you could come back, you could send spacecraft to Mars, you could orbit large payloads, you could do all kinds of things. But it was too expensive, and it depended on political support to go anywhere. And the trouble with political support is it kind of comes and goes, as we saw with Apollo. The sustainable phase is essentially self-funding over time. Companies make money by sending stuff into space, and they don't need for the government to want to pump a lot of cash into them. And unlike the command economy phase, they have a built-in incentive to make what they do more efficient, more reliable, less expensive as they go along. The cost of government launches in space actually went up from Apollo to the later days of the space shuttle. Whereas, as I note, under just to use SpaceX as an example, Elon Musk and SpaceX have dropped the cost of getting a pound to orbit to roughly 1/20th of what it was with the space shuttle. And the new Starship promises to reduce it by a factor of at least 10 more. So that's a huge improvement, and all kinds of things that you can't do at $55,000 a kilogram, which was the cost of the space shuttle, are doable when you're talking like $200 a kilogram, which is what Elon Musk is promising for Starship.
Right. And I was thinking of analogies of other industry. One was, and you could tell me if this is accurate or other analogies come to mind, was the PC revolution of Charles Babbage, the visionaries. And then you have the people who built these gigantic mainframes, the scientists behind it, the Atten Nassoff, John von Neumann, others. And then you have the miniaturization and the personal revolution with Apple coming around in the 80s. Do you see a similar type of dynamic there, or other industries that you think are a better analogy?
Now, that's a pretty good analogy. Another is aviation. You know, you had sort of the visionary period where people like Langley were working on heavier than air planes, and a lot of people were making fun of them and saying, obviously, things that are heavier than air can't fly. Then you get the Wright brothers, and then for a while, planes are kind of toys, and then they become government-funded military projects, and progress gets a lot faster. But then, and this is where, with aviation, they got to this point a lot faster than we got with space. After World War I, the U.S. government very consciously decided to promote the development of more reliable, less expensive technology, and they did it through a pretty fine-tuned system of airmail subsidies, which rewarded greater capability and lower costs, the ability to fly at night, navigate at night, and things like that, as a way of pushing the technology along. And that caused it to advance very rapidly. We're just kind of now reaching that stage in the space world.
That's an interesting thing. It's something that Elon Musk always hammers on about the launch cost reduction, that I think Starship will be something like $270 a kilo, down from the $50,000 a kilo you mentioned in the space shuttle. And Robert Zubrin, I think he said that if you just consider the energy to get into space from a purely physics standpoint, the amount of energy isn't that much different from an airplane. So it could be as low as 67 a kilo, although orbital flight is a little bit tricky. Things get a little bit hot, and the whole business of burning up if you don't have a good heat shield. So maybe it's not that simple. But yeah, talk about the implications of that you get into in your book and then your other writings elsewhere of if it truly is that cheap.
Sure. Well, I mean, and Bob is exactly right. I mean, if you just leaving aside the various engineering complications of going into space, the energy budget for flying from the surface to orbit is pretty much what you get from flying from the United States to, say, London. And that means the costs ought to be, well, on that order, at least. And, you know, the reason why it's been so much more expensive in the past is just, you know, we're not very good at going to orbit. And it would cost you a lot more to fly to London if you threw the airplane away after each flight, which is what we did until quite recently. And even with the space shuttle, we threw most of it away. So, yeah, the physics suggests we could do it a lot more cheaply than we've been doing it. And it's like everything else. When something's super expensive, you can only use it for things that are very high value. And as it gets cheaper, you can use it for things that are lower value. For example, you know, in the early days of ocean transportation, it was so expensive to bring things from the other side of the world to, say, Europe, that only things of the highest value were worth it, like spices, which are very light, but were very, very valuable. Now I go to the grocery store and I can buy apples from New Zealand, still ripe, for like $1.69 a pound. And I'm always amazed that they managed to somehow put those in a ship and bring them all the way to the United States from literally the other side of the world and sell them to me for that cheaply. Why? Well, shipping's a lot cheaper than it used to be. And that's how it works all down the line, whether you want to use PC as an example or aviation or shipping. As you lower the costs, you find a lot more applications where technology makes sense.
Yeah, I think for a while, I've heard some say that there was a chicken and egg problem with getting launch costs lower. As you said, there's not really things that are made in space because the costs are so high, because it would have to be something that would be ultra high value, but it's so high cost that people won't do it. So getting this started was a tricky thing. I made this analogy before on the show, but a lot of what kicked off the age of discovery in the past, spices or furs for fashion, it's really a lot of kind of luxury, wealthy nonsense for rich people. So I thought Kylie Jenner needs to promote Moonrock earrings, and that alone could probably kick off the space age faster than anything else. So just get people to waste money on it.
I love it.
Well, you have an interesting anecdote, too, that I think you said the National Space Society conventions in the 80s were sort of like Star Trek conventions, and now they're a lot more professional, and you see venture capitalists and stuff. So at least from what you've seen on the inside, how have you noticed this change happen in the industry?
Yeah, well, it's really true. I mean, you know, the National Space Society was formed by merging two different organizations. One of them was a fairly stuffy establishment outfit called the National Space Institute, which was founded by Wernher von Braun. And the other was a much more, I don't know, hippie-ish, you could say, organization called the L5 Society, which was founded originally by Princeton students who took Gerard K. O'Neill's seminar on space colonies. And it had more of the hippie-ish Star Trek nerd kind of character. And you had a lot of people with buttons and, you know, like almost like a science fiction convention, really, in terms of its feel, I think. So the National Space Society conventions in the early days really felt a lot like a science fiction convention or a Star Trek convention. There were lots of people who were interested in it, but they weren't really doing it. They may have been doing some stuff. There were people designing menus for space stations and experimenting with hydroponic farming and that sort of thing. But that really changed. I mean, I was involved in the 80s and into the 90s. Then I got married. I had a kid. I got busy. I really kind of let it drop for about 10 years. And then I went back to cover one for the Atlantic. And it was a shocking change. I mean, there were still people with buttons around. But, you know, there were a lot of venture capitalists in Brioni suits. There were people with companies that were actually building things and bending metal. You know, one of the student activists that I remembered from the old days was now a professor of astronautics at MIT, and another one was in charge of space stuff for Google. And it felt much more like a professional conference because it was much more of a professional conference. It was a conference built around an industry that was really booming. And that was over a decade ago now. It's come so much farther now that, you know, it used to be when I talked about space or space law or the space industry, people would either sort of look at me funny or make, you know, Jetsons jokes or Star Trek jokes. Now everybody gets it. They know there's a lot of money involved. They know there's a lot going on. And, you know, there's a big market. One of the sort of jumping off place markets that people have talked about for space for quite a while is tourism. And I remember I was at the White House back in the 90s, and the Office of Science and Technology Policy had a program where Wolfgang Demisch, who was a guy from UBS in Switzerland, talked about tourism as an engine for space growth and how basically you wouldn't have an international air freight system without the cross subsidies from tourists paying part of the fuel bill for planes with their cargo holds full of freight, and how that had really jump-started so much of aviation. And you see that with Blue Origin. You see that with SpaceX to a degree. You see that with Virgin Galactic. Where Elon Musk has been smart is he's also built his own customer for SpaceX with the Starlink internet service, which is satellite based. So now he's got a customer to hire SpaceX to launch a lot of satellites and then fund them. And it works great. I'm talking to you right now. I'm a Starlink beta tester. So I'm talking to you over my Starlink connection, even as we speak, and it works great.
Yeah, I've been in Mexico recently, and people are absolutely chomping at the bit down there for it, just because the national carrier isn't terribly reliable, nor are the private companies. And that's true in a lot of the places in the developing world. So that alone, I mean, just is a mint to print money once it's fully operational.
Yeah. And, you know, even here, I mean, I could have drilled holes in my wall and put it up myself, but I paid somebody who drills holes in walls all day long to do it instead. And he was a fancy audio video installer who was thrilled to have a chance to do a Starlink installation. But he said, you know, I've got all these people who they're rich people who have these fancy houses up in the mountains, but then they can't get internet and they're looking at paying Comcast $50,000 or more to run a line to their house. This is going to be a complete game changer for them. That's true here. And of course, it's quintuply true when you get out in the third world.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Well, I'm curious too, since you're a law professor and legal expert, some of the implications about as more people are moving into space, as it's not just a couple of dozen people at a time on the International Space Station, but the trafficking of a lot of people, what this will mean. One big thing that always gets referenced is the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. And I spoke with another guest on the series, Robert Zimmerman, who thinks it will be a source of conflict because you basically can't militarize anything in space, but that means that you couldn't really protect any assets you have out there. So it's going to be a source of conflict, not really a mediation. But very briefly, what is that? And what do you think are some of the near-term implications of that? And it could be challenged or amended, or what do you think that will look like?
Well, there are a bunch of interesting discussions going on around that. One of the things the Outer Space Treaty does is it says that astronauts are envoys of mankind, and essentially sort of get treated like diplomats if they crash land in your country. And there's another provision, the Rescue and Return Agreement, that says that if they crash in your country, you have to rescue them and return them to their home country. And some people are asking, are space tourists really astronauts for the purpose of this agreement? And I think the answer right now is yes, but that may change as the numbers continue to go up. It may just be time to renegotiate the Outer Space Treaty. It's over 50 years old, and 50 years is really a pretty long time for most treaties, and the world's changed a lot. The Outer Space Treaty was really written against the background of the Cold War and the fear that a race for the moon and the planets might lead to nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore, and it's just not clear that we need that aspect of it. As for military presence in space, that's a little unclear. The Outer Space Treaty's limits on military activity in space are real, but it's possible that some kinds of asset protection could be counted as policing, and that would be outside the treaty. And the treaty also provides that any sort of military equipment or personnel can be used if they're necessary to explore outer space, the moon, and other celestial bodies. And if you need protection, then they're necessary. So that might override the provision as well.
Legally, what is the state of affairs? There's a misunderstanding about international waters that essentially you're just in a law-free zone. So The Simpsons had, I think, an episode about this of casinos set right up offshore, or people point to pirate radio, and it's not as if you can do anything you want, but yes, it is murky. Legally, I mean, if we wanted to set up, I don't know, orbital cockfighting rings or whatever extra legal nonsense you can think of that would go on there, a sort of super Las Vegas, are you beholden to any laws if you're off of the globe?
Well, yeah, everything that is launched into space right now has got to be carried out of the registry of some nation under the Outer Space Treaty. And that nation has both the authority and the duty to supervise what its nationals or people operating on its registry do in outer space. Now, if you are on the registry of a country where cockfighting and gambling are legal, then you're fine. The United States has a series of laws that specifically apply to the high seas and other extraterritorial areas. It's all space is lumped in as part of what's called the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States. And there are some laws that address that. Most laws don't. By default, domestic laws don't apply outside the geographical borders of the United States, but Congress has the power to make them apply that way if it wants to.
Okay, so it's more legally you're bound by whatever nation you launch from. It's more of a question of enforcement, I suppose.
Which is also how ships typically work. I mean, we have a lot of people with ships under Panamanian registry or whatever. And generally speaking, they have a lot of freedoms on board those ships that they wouldn't have if they were carried on the registry of a more restrictive country like the United States, which is why they're not.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing that I don't know for you as a legal scholar, if you have any pet peeves of things that are widely misunderstood by the public. There's a terrible direct-to-video movie with Kelsey Grammer in it called Money Plane. I guess he's not flying too high after Frasier ended. And it's basically a giant illegal operation where, according to the movie's logic, anything goes because they're in airspace and not on ground. And I thought, I'm not a legal expert, but I'm very certain it doesn't work that way without even bothering to look it up. So I don't know if there's any other legal pet peeves that rankle you.
That one, I missed that movie somehow.
You didn't miss very much, so I don't think you have to check it out. Well, I wonder, with like specific visions that you've referenced, others have referenced, you talked about O'Neill, who was, I think, an instructor of Jeff Bezos, and he famously came up with O'Neill colonies, which are these gigantic orbital colonies that Jeff Bezos thinks is the way to go forward. He thinks it's a fool's errand to go for Martian colonization, which is what Elon Musk is interested in. He thinks it's the best real estate in the solar system off-world because it proffers all sorts of advantages as an atmosphere, all these other things. It's relatively close to Earth. What sort of, I don't know, how do you see things playing out with these sort of different space billionaires have different visions? And what do you think will be most likely to happen?
I'm pleased to have a diversity of approaches here. If one of them is wrong, maybe the other one will be right. The O'Neill concept goes back to a seminar O'Neill taught in, I want to say something like 1974 at Princeton. And he asked the students, is the surface of a planet the best place for an expanding technological civilization? And the students researched and responded, no. And over several iterations of that course, they developed an idea that you should have orbital colonies that were built using space resources from the asteroids, perhaps from the moon, not much from Earth because it's expensive to launch out of our gravity well. And these would be very large. They would be rotating to produce artificial gravity. They might hold 10 or 20,000 or more people. If you saw the movie Interstellar, there's a brief shot of one of those toward the end. And Jeff Bezos was very taken with this idea. This is his number one approach. Elon Musk is much bigger on Mars. I think both of them believe in colonies on the moon, but primarily as a place to support their main ventures on the Mars or in orbit. I think the answer is going to turn out to be that they're both right in the sense that both of those approaches have a lot to recommend them. If you have orbital colonies around the Earth, the upside of those is you're much closer to the Earth, not only physically in terms of people going back and forth, but also in a communication sense, the speed of light lag is going to be on the order of what you'd find at the moon, maybe a second or two each way. Whereas, you know, Mars is distant from us, not only in space, but in time. It takes hours for a signal to make a round trip to Mars. And that means they're isolated, not only physically, but sort of intellectually and socially. Now, whether that's a bug or a feature kind of depends on your attitude. I think Musk likes the idea of that distance, both physical and social and intellectual, as a way to have a real frontier. I think Bezos thinks that you can do a lot more business with the home planet if you're close. And you know, as I say, they both have their virtues. And honestly, I think both concepts are probably going to turn out to be workable. So, you know, odds are they'll both be right.
Well, speaking of billionaires, a thing that you and others have mentioned is that the first Musk is sort of on the verge of possibly becoming a trillionaire if the market cap keeps growing for Tesla. But the first quadrillionaire could very well be someone who does asteroid mining. So why would there be so much money in that? And I guess, and then the legal implications, can anyone just claim anything in outer space and they have ownership of it? Or how would that work? Hey, everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, okay, let's start with the first one. If you look at the value of the metals on some of the larger asteroids, like people say Psyche is worth several quadrillions, depending on exactly how much, depending on various factors, but in the range of quadrillions of dollars. I mean, the trouble with these things, it's not useless to value it that way, but it's not exactly meaningful. It would be like trying, you know, at the time of Columbus, try to put a value on the New World based on how many goats it would buy or something. I mean, you know, you can't really, I don't care if Psyche were a solid chunk of platinum, you couldn't really sell it on Earth for quadrillions of dollars because you'd saturate the market and drive the price of platinum down to nothing. Nonetheless, a lot of platinum is worth a lot. You could do a lot with it. It has value, but the dollar values people put on it is mostly just to get a headline in a newspaper. Most of the value of all space materials is really what you could do with them in the way of space construction, whether it's in Earth orbit or on Mars or somewhere else. Materials from space are much cheaper to use in space than materials that have to be lifted off the surface of the Earth. So, you know, it may well be, in fact, that the most valuable asteroids are the carbonaceous chondrites that are full of oxygen and water and things like that, rather than the metallic ones that have gold and silver and platinum in them. At any rate, though, there is a lot of value out there. We really don't have a language or a math or an economic model that even lets us put a value on opening up the solar system, except to say that we could support probably hundreds of times the current population of Earth, and all of those people could be probably hundreds of times wealthier than the average person on Earth today in terms of their lifestyle. So it's a phenomenal amount of wealth. Now, how you get it, it's not quite true that anyone can claim anything, but it's not so far off. Under U.S. law now, if you discover and develop resources in space, they belong to you. There was a statute passed and signed by President Obama that's been implemented by an executive order signed by President Trump. The Biden administration seems to buy into it. And honestly, if you're looking for any hopeful sign of the condition of the United States right now, it's that we've really maintained an excellent space policy so far, at least through three very different administrations, pretty consistently. And that's actually probably one of the most important things we could be doing right now. So, you know, will people get fabulously rich from this? Yes. Will one of them be Elon Musk? Maybe, maybe not. Could very well be somebody we've never heard of. I think he's going to do just fine out of it all. Just the Tesla plus Starlink valuation alone has a chance to push him into the trillionaire category. Or, hey, you know, the way inflation is going, I could be a trillionaire one day. that's the other way you could get there. There was some Saturday Night Live skit like that with Dan Aykroyd and Jimmy Carter saying, wouldn't you like to drive a $600,000 car? That could be real. Inflation is our friend. Well, leaving that aside, though, I think Elon Musk could be is going to be made very wealthy by this stuff, probably, unless somebody finds a way to bring it down. Even before you start talking about bringing back asteroidal materials to Earth or helium-3 from the moon, I will note the Chinese are very interested in this. They are sending missions to the moon to explore for ice and minerals. They are doing design work on space structures that are on the order of miles in diameter. And, you know, I have a hunch they may even do something crazy like dust off the old nuclear Orion concept so they can launch several thousand tons into orbit at once.
Well, there's cause for concern with like that sort of a new space race, although that could force the United States to get in back in action a lot more. But with the spirit of the series, comparing what will happen in the next few decades in space to the age of discovery, something that is a tradition on your blog is on Columbus Day, you quote a passage from a great book by Samuel Eliot Morison called Admiral of the Ocean Sea about Christopher Columbus, that what Columbus did was really reinvigorate Europe and Western civilization that at the time was always under the threat of conquest. The Ottoman Empire had been making advancements. It reinvigorated intellectually, it reinvigorated, I suppose you could say, spiritually in the sense of the humanist understanding. And when you talk about SpaceX, you call it the America that it works, that in 2021, with the multitude of reasons for pessimism, that there's at least some glimmering lights of things that we can look forward to in the future. So to wrap up these different things, what do you see about the what it means for a space program and kind of like the humanistic optimism of what it can do for humanity in a similar way as what you quote from that passage about Christopher Columbus?
Yeah, well, you know, John Maynard Keynes wrote about animal spirits in driving the economy, and I'm not much of a Keynesian, but I think there's, you know, definitely something to be said for that. And I know there's, you know, there's psychological research as well as just common sense that shows that when people perceive themselves as living in a zero-sum world, they act very differently than when they perceive themselves to be living in a world of expanding opportunities, a positive sum world where your interactions with other people can leave everybody better off and where you sort of live in a world of abundance. The passage from Samuel Eliot Morison's book points out that Europe pre-Columbus was a place of shrinking horizons and people were had a generally negative view. And to the extent they were thinking about wealth, it was more how to preserve what they had or grab some from somebody nearby. And after Columbus, they saw that there were quite literally broader horizons out there, and their whole approach to life changed in a much more positive way. And I think that's right. Now, one historical difference, Columbus is in sort of bad odor these days in some sectors, possibly unfairly. But one of the big differences between the age of exploration in the past and the age of exploration that's coming is that in the age of exploration of the past, there was a fair amount of oppression of the natives wherever you went, you know, in keeping with the line. I don't think it's from Kipling. I forget who said it. You know, we have the Maxim gun and they have not. That's not an issue with space exploration and space development and, dare I say it, space colonization, because unless we turn out to find an enormous surprise, there don't appear to be any natives anywhere we're going. It's all wide open for us. And that's just a very different kind of world and environment. And I think we should be glad that that's how it is. We should be glad there aren't Martians or Venusians or somebody out there to fight with.
Yeah, it makes for great Golden Age sci-fi pulp adventure novels, but actually having to deal with it would be, pretty ugly. And good thing not to have to contend with. I agree with you on that one. Well, for listeners who want to dive into what you've written on this topic, you have a book, America's New Destiny in Space, and you blog about the subject frequently on insupunted.com. So, Glenn, thank you for joining us and sharing all this with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.